Hey, welcome to Taking It Down. Hope you enjoy your stay. We are the TV and streaming podcast for the Alabama Take, one of several of the Alabama Take's family of podcasts. Before I go any deeper, let's hear from our friends over at Polyphonic Press.
Hey, this is Jeremy from Polyphonic Press. Along with my co-host and best friend, John Van Dyke, we are exploring classic albums completely at random. At the top of each show, we have no idea what album we're going to be listening to. We have the patented random album generator to give us an album. Sometimes it's an album we're very familiar with, and sometimes it's an artist we have never heard of. Either way, it gives us a chance to really listen to these classic releases, and gives us insights that we may never have thought of before.
For something to come out of them. Agreed. Maybe he needed the other Beatles in the room at that time.
Well, I think so, and I think if you watched that Peter Jackson documentary from a few years ago about the Let It Be sessions, I think, you know, it was kind of, the writing was on the wall. I mean, they were breaking up.
John Lennon didn't sign the papers to officially dissolve the Beatles until 1974.
So if this sounds interesting, be sure to follow Polyphonic Press on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and everywhere else podcasts are available. We upload every Tuesday morning, and we strongly encourage you to listen along with us. Cheers.
Be sure to check out the new and improved AlabamaTake.com, thealabamatake.com. It's gotten a facelift. We've tried to incorporate podcasts to be more accessible there on the site. You can use the site to easily subscribe to any of our family of podcasts, as well as continue to read the fantastic writing and thoughts that are going on there. Most recently from author Sam Simmons about gardening as a revolution. Head to thealabamatake.com, check that out. I'm Blaine, I'm the host. I am one more episode deeper into Three Body Problems. Slow going on that one. A few things are standing out to me, though. I'm not sure I'm as interested in the video game stuff as the show thinks I should be. Parts of it seem too disjointed for even a three-cordon series about the 1960s China, present-day London scientist, and a video game. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Benedict Wong's detective seems to be operating in a completely different show than the rest of the cast. Plus, there's like this huge component of this type of show. It's made for message board investigating, which is probably avoided with Netflix's drop all episodes and forget about it method. I'm still in. I still find it interesting. I'm curious as to where it's going to go. I haven't read the book, but it just doesn't feel as lived in or as palpable as Benioff and Weiss's previous work with adapting Game of Thrones. And so much of that show felt tangible and real despite its fantasy and medieval tropes. Then there's Manhunt on Apple TV Plus. Are any of you watching this? Because, again, I can recommend it based off of some aspects that are going on, but I can criticize a lot more. The show just feels so anachronistic with its choices that I wouldn't even be surprised if an episode featured the Rolling Stones playing in a bar. There's a story there, and it's one I haven't heard enough of. On today's show, though, we're going to talk about Shogun, Episode 7, A Stick of Time. We'll talk broadly before we discuss any of the details of the show. And I will talk broadly about Sugar on Apple TV Plus. And then in the back half, I will spoil a lot of those first two episodes of Sugar. So let's get into the show this week.
Take projection.
Alrighty. Welcome. Hey, I'm not sure about other podcast apps at this point, but Apple Podcasts have implemented transcripts, and I cannot recommend that enough. If your podcast app of choice has a transcript option and it's got like a search function, that's a way to go. I was listening to one the other night and I got interrupted, you know, and so I just clicked on the transcript and read a little, muted it, and then just read along. It's perfect.
Can you like do a keyword search?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what
I
did.
All right, listeners, now search for boner.
It'll come up later. It'll come up. It'll scroll through all the times it'll come up.
I was going to say,
so as many times as
that'll be like control effing the word the at the end of like a long. you're looking at one of 420 options.
Yeah, right. 69.
Well, it was one or the other.
We're going to continue our discussion of Shogun, a series that warrants the discussion, we think. And we're going to get into, I will actually, solo, get into the Apple TV Plus show Sugar on the back half. We don't start with anything that'll spoil either of them until we get past a few things.
Did I think the Bears' first spinoff would be centered on Sugar and on Apple TV? No. No. Not at all. But here we are.
Next season, Salt. If it's a show we haven't discussed, we open the floor to label it as, you know, recommendation or recommended with certain qualifications or just a hell no, stay away from it. We've discussed how good Shogun is, but this is the first time Donovan's been back in a minute. Donovan, what do you think?
I'm a little primed for this because my college has a communication and media arts program. So we subscribe to American Cinematographer, and the cover story this month was Shogun and all the, like, just how gorgeous it looks and, like, all the behind the scenes stuff with the sets and all the work that goes into it. And, like, yeah, there's parts where you zoom out and it's like, okay, like, that's Osaka Castle is CGI. But, like, right, this show, for if nothing else, it looks gorgeous.
Donovan also owns 9 katanas, it should be said. So
that's definitely true.
Majoring in samurai, yes.
Yeah, I'm actually, you know, I've always been a little suspicious of people who own swords, because it's like, just get a gun and kill people the normal way.
Yeah, for real.
You know?
Swords.
Just be normal.
Yeah, come on, dorks.
be more English or American. So we're going to cover A Stick of Time in a little bit. Let me go over a few spoiler-free discussion points about Sugar on Apple TV+. Like to get everything spoiler-free out of the way in case anybody wants to just listen to the beginning and then come back later. Guys, y'all got to get on this Sugar.
Does he put his donkey outside when he's sad? Is that what makes it so good?
I'm not putting me donkey out.
He's like, I'm not putting me donkey outside when I'm sad.
Yeah. No. Hell no. Exactly. This show is brazen and wonderful. I cannot. And brazen in its style. I just fucking love it. It was like, oh man, it was a breath of fresh air. And it's going to scratch that Perry Mason itch we've been missing.
Oh, good. Okay.
So hard.
I'm very curious for this show because I've seen good stuff for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also seen Alan Sepinwall say, like, it's one show. And this is a spoiler-free headline because this is okay. Just his review, right? So he's like, it's one show and then there's a twist and it's another show. And okay. He's like, and I liked both shows pretty well. But I didn't feel like the twist worked, so I'm interested to see if it sustains.
Apple TV Plus has put up the first two episodes in that first one. Man, that's just as stellar of a pilot as I've seen in a while. I was floored in a way. It's very stylistic, but I'm a fan for that shit. You know, if you're gonna do something, do it a little different, put your own spin on it. This is certainly leaning into the noir aspects. And it wants to be that. And
I'm not hearing any problems.
Yeah, for real. Colin Farrell is magnetic in this show. As a hetero man, I'm just dying to have sex with him.
You don't have sex with Colin Farrell, Blaine.
What happens? He has sex with you?
He has sex with you,
well,
yes.
Yeah, that can happen. So I'm going to cover Sugar, the first two episodes on the back half today. Well, let's get into Shogun. Here's your spoiler warning. A Stick of Time is what we're going to... I'm asking for these two gentlemen's a stick of time from each of them. You know, we're back in the saddle of the horse, riding to the gates of Edo once again on this week's episode of Shogun. The seventh of the series. My goodness, we don't have much left, and it seems like there's a lot of things to get finished, right?
They're blowing through it.
They really are. It makes you wonder.
But I also don't feel like they're spinning their wheels. But yeah, there's a ton of stuff still to do.
Apparently, they're only about the halfway point of the book.
Okay. I've never read it.
Yeah, I want to, but no. Hey, the significance... I mentioned this last week when I was flying solo. Have y'all made an inference on the... significance of the gentleman with the shaved heads versus those who have full head of hair?
I have seen some chatter online that they could be using this to show a difference in generation, that the younger men tended to have that, and it is purely a personal choice. It's not... I thought maybe at first it was like to denote that they are a different you know, once you graduate to a full samurai with all the rights and privileges that that entails, you could just let your hair grow.
Yeah, same here.
But, you know, they reference Korea a lot, and apparently the men who would have been in Korea may have opted for styling that took less upkeep since they were away at war for a prolonged period. It's also been theorized that they did the younger guys are doing the top cut because you're just cooler when wearing the combat helmet that they would have been wearing. So
that's fascinating.
The generational read is maybe the one that the show wants us to take, even though there are a few older guys who are sporting the look. Most of the time, the ones that have a little more experience have the beard and the long hair. And then you have, say, Toranaga's son, who, you know, that poor shaved head. I guess we'll get into that.
That poor sap.
Toranaga, little badass, as they called him. He, before pillowing a woman.
Little badass.
Isn't that what they called him? No, that's not what they called him. Yeah, man, that opening scene, how about it?
I don't know why this is my review of the show so far, but like my only thought is that, and this is completely not related to what you want us to talk about, but Toranaga just has an excellent employee benefits program. Just excellent.
Go on.
Every episode, every level.
Tell us more.
Oh, you know, you got the House of Willows, you know, you got like...
You do get some consorts.
He's going to give you swords. He's going to call you Hatamoto. You don't even know what that means. Like, that's going to make you strive.
He will not give you your fucking ship and men.
Definitely not his.
No matter how many times you ask.
Blackthorn has basically become the Bernie Sanders meme. I'm here again to ask you.
Asking for my ship and my men.
everything about this series is so magically done. You know, the tension between the brothers there in the fog. What a nice visual touch to clothe that scene in so much fog. It's,
you're talking about in their first meeting?
Yeah, because they're in the woods and they meet each other. They're both camps, both armies are meeting, and it's just a nice flair to give you the nod that we don't know what's going to happen between them, and let's put the fog there.
Aside from his brother looking absolutely spectacular.
Just badass, right?
I mean, what a look.
Is this show so awesome for us because most television shows are mediocre, or is this show truly operating on all cylinders?
Like, I'm not smart enough to be like, hey, this is the reason why it's such a good show. But it also feels like a really big swing for the, like, big swing in a way that, like, sometimes shows are, I think it was the critic Emily Vandermeer, back when she was doing TV criticism more, said, you know, one of the things that she hated about like prestige drama is that so many, especially on streaming, is that so many shows were willing to like be a solid B. Mm-hmm. And then like if they really hit a big one, it's like, well, that's a B+, instead of like, I'm going for the A every time. And if I really hit it out of a park, it's an A+. And this one feels like it's not really holding back.
I agree with Donovan. And I think the first week that we discussed it, the thing that was so striking to me was how willing it is, and I know it's based on a book, so they have the source material, but how willing to just be a conventional great story it is, that it is striving to be the A+, in its delivery, and it's, as Donovan was talking about, cinematography, set design, all these things, but it's also just, here's a series of events, a journey that we're taking these well-developed characters on. We're not relying on the shock value that a Game of Thrones, a House of Cards, whatever kind of influenced, you know, people saw how successful those shows were and had to say, like, you know, let's just mirror that shock and awe is the only way. And this obviously has that element, but it's slow at times, you know, and it's just kind of a classic journey of multiple heroes.
I've been interested watching it for myself at how much, like, at many times it is basically a conventional TV show, just in the sense that it's like small group of characters, you know, in people talking, and like most of the episode is dialogue. Yet through all that, it feels incredibly epic to me. Like, there feels like there's a sweep to stuff that's happening, not just in Japan, but in the way that it's intersecting with John and the Europeans and, you know, the colonialism knocking on Japan's doors. Mm. It feels like it's got a vision and sweep to it. Even if like its building blocks are basic, but I mean, you know, you put them together in the right way, you built something great.
Right. And the arc of that sweep is maybe the opposite of what we're used to, where you start in the micro and then let the characters become macro players or involved in big, you know, sweeping things. Whereas this started a complete overload of, like, now I know who everybody is, but you feel like you start with 100 characters and it was dealing with these big ideas. Like, you know, what was it, the second or third episode where they have Blackthorn doing the map of the world as he understands it. And it goes from that to, oh, we've been in this same village for how many episodes now?
Yeah.
With kind of fairly, domestic isn't the right word, but more small scale concerns.
Mm-hmm. That feels right. Domestic. It feels right.
I have been, like, it was episode one was a lot, right? Like, I enjoyed it, but it's like everyone's wearing a cool hat and I can't tell anyone apart.
Yeah.
But I have been, what Adam said, like, the show has been really happy to just, like, let you fill in the gaps and, like, let you kind of figure out people's relationships. And then it's like, oh, and here's how they, like, I think it was said before, but, like, it was literally this episode. I'm like, oh, right, yeah, he's Buntero's grandfather,
right?
Or father. I mean, you know, like, that's right, they're all related. I kind of, but they don't really pull it together until you're like, okay, you already know who all these people are, and here's the way they're loyal to Toranaga.
Well, in reporting here from the Reddit beat, as I always do, there's multiple multiple threads every week where somebody's saying, now, how is X related to Y? You know, specifically from characters, and it's what Donovan's talking about of, like, you understand on the surface how everyone is relating to each other in the moment that we're witnessing, but it can be easy to forget all of the history that they're bringing to those moments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I've really liked that development. And another character, I think, not a huge character, but another character I think that paid off well with is where you see the relationship between the passed away Taiko's wife and Toranaga. And they have this kind of jocular, you're not really, you know, they obviously, she's an ally and they've known each other a long time, but as it develops, then you're like, oh, no, okay, like, that's who she is. And that's why they're on the same side.
You know? Is it? You're not talking about Lady Ochaba, are you?
No, the older woman.
Oh, yeah,
the wife.
Who's now a nun.
Yeah, not the consort. Yes, yeah, the wife.
Thank you. Kudos to Donovan for turning me on to this show, because when I first heard of it, I thought, it's a goddamn remake, or, you know, I really didn't know. Is it a reboot, remake? I don't care. It's been done. Let's put this away. I'm not interested. Donovan sends us a message. You know, we stay on top of shows with one another. That's how this podcast gets done. And he says, hey, Shogun's good. The first episode's good.
Mm-hmm.
And I begrudgingly, I didn't say it in the text, but I begrudgingly thought, okay, well, I'll watch it give us something to talk about. But my God, it's, Donovan, you weren't here for this conversation, but a lot of Game of Thrones comparisons gets tossed about willy-nilly, but I do think it's a little bit more Deadwood.
People have been throwing around Game of Thrones, and that, I don't think I could tell you why, but it doesn't quite hit for me. It's doing something else, I think.
I think the backstories everybody's coming in with,
you know,
and you figuring out he's related to him, and this house has this kind of relationship with this other house.
I guess I could see that. Yeah.
And the dragons.
Obviously.
You know, there's a thing that this show is now talking about more outwardly than it was early on, and it's the almost death wish that a lot of the characters have. And how they're dealing with, you know, a European and our Western sensibilities about the value of life, and that running up against a culture that did not share maybe those same, what we would consider like tenets of life or like the fabric of society, all these things. And I don't think shows like Game of Thrones ever really dealt with it in the same way that they already are 7 episodes in. I think there's a lot more.
That's a really great point, I think.
There's a lot more depth to this, and I have a buddy who we were discussing the newer Lord of the Rings series last summer, 2 summers ago, whenever that was, and I said, well, are you watching the new Game of Thrones adjacent thing? He said, no, there's a certain kind of meanness and cynicism to Game of Thrones that I don't enjoy, and I thought, you're dead on about that. That's like a very pure-hearted thing to say, and it made me admire this guy a lot. Shogun, to me, has more interesting philosophical things going on than just, like, shock factor, power struggle, boobs.
but it's got all of that too.
It does.
It has all those cool things too.
I will take away a little of the show's credit in this episode only because it got a ham-fisted with the idea of fate. I thought it did more telling than showing than it usually does, just a little. Every character, it seemed like, was talking about fate, and it's what Adam was saying, though, because that's the culture that they live in.
What's an egregious example of that to you? I think I know what you're getting at.
No, well, it starts subtle, because the Anjin says, you know, he's with Torinaga no matter their fate.
Yeah, no matter what.
No matter our fate. And he decides on what to do. Should we attempt the ship or piss around and accept our fates? You know, there's that. And that's not egregious, but it seemed like they started just stacking it as the
episode
went on.
Yeah, Lady, I know who everyone is. I have no read on anyone's names.
Lady Ochiba.
Except for Fuji, that one just sticks with me.
Well, yeah, Fuji, she's easy to remember.
but, you know, she said, I stared fate in the eyes and scratched it, you know, scratched its eyes out. Yeah, other characters do talk. I don't, you know, it didn't really come across as super ham-handed, though, because I felt like it had been there in other episodes, previous episodes, and now it was, like, really rearing its head as, you know, for whatever reason, Torinaga seems in a no-win situation.
The show does know how to find good comic relief, especially with Yashabushi, I think his name is, when he asks, "Why am I speaking to you?" That was just such a good little beat. There.
He's funny no matter what.
I love that actor.
Yes.
He's very expressive.
Show me his other movies and I'll dive right in.
I mean, he's great too, right? Because like he's such a snake in the, like he's absolutely
a lovable snake.
Like, he's kind of like the worst person in the show, honestly though, because he's not loyal, he's not honorable.
Mm-mm.
He's playing both sides. But that, you know, that scamp.
He's a rascal.
He even referenced the boiling from the first episode again with like no remorse. Or
yeah, like, wish you'd been in there, huh?
Why am I speaking to you?
We talked a little bit, kind of in some of my digging. A few Japanese viewers said, "Oh, he is like an archetype of Japanese cinema. Like if you've seen enough Kurosawa, you are familiar with this character,
the Mifune character, usually.
The village idiot,
No. More
is it not? There's no.
He's a snake, and he's more he's dumb but clever.
I mean, and he's a good guy, but it's almost like there's a reflection of this in like the Han Solo character in the first Star Wars.
Exactly.
Right? Okay. Where like he's a scoundrel, he's a rogue, right? Like he does. Right, like think of the scene in Star Wars, right, when Han's chasing the stormtroopers down, and then he runs into the big room full of stormtroopers, and now he's running away. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's cool, but he's also a fool. He's comic relief.
Yeah, so Han Solo is more of an analog than a villain. Was Blackthorn's outburst at the surrender a bit of a cloak and dagger, orchestrated by Torinaga?
I'm curious.
I thought of. Earlier in the series, remarking that the key to a hunt is to have the hawk that you know you have different people in different roles, all these sorts of things, and to know, and it's why would you bring this? They think he's a barbarian, you know, volatile barbarian into these high level meetings, if not to just see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he keeps harping on, they won't know what he's gonna do with the cannons. I think you can extrapolate that across pretty much everything that he. Make it up to.
Well, Blackthorn does get really frustrated because they won't try the Crimson Sky attack, and he says that, and that's the only thing he says in Japanese to Torinaga early in the episode, and then later in the surrender, Torinaga makes it a point to say Crimson Sky, but he does this pause as if to say, we're go for it, or we're doing it, or this is your cue, or why don't you try something here?
That was my idea. You guys got anything? Yeah.
Yeah. It left me, you know, that like I can't speculate, but every episode has left me like, okay, what's happening next?
Oh, yeah.
Especially like, you know, I was thinking about, because like Torinaga, right? Like he's at least construed like to feel like to us, the viewers, as like kind of the good guy. And you know, you can think like, and he's mostly honorable, right? Like he wants to hold the realm together. He doesn't want things to fall back into the anarchy of the Civil War period, when it was literally like 200 years of civil war. You know, that's something pretty horrible to come out of. But also, like, it's like he's kind of playing his own game too. But it's like I'm just having such like he's the protagonist. So you're like, I want to see him win. I want to see him outsmart people. I want to, you know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. He has been shown to be the most. What the show has chosen to show us, he's the most honorable one of the power players, right?
Yes.
So, of course, we're going to root for him, even though he's still this, you know, military figure.
Much, much more so than Ishido and the others, especially, who are fairly cynical.
Right. The other regents are, I don't know, it's easy to root for the guy who's, like you said, trying to keep things together and... I kind of have a knee-jerk reaction to the ones that are in the kind of in the employ of the Portuguese who. I would be interested to know more about how Christianity infiltrated up to positions of power like that in like an acceptable way. You know, that it went from being this foreign thing to like you could be one of the five most powerful men in the country and kind of be entering to the. I mean, it's money, but
money, yeah. Money, guns, and trade is a really good incentive, right?
Donovan, you have heavy opinions about Catholics if you want to just wrap them off.
The Catholics, the Portuguese.
Yeah.
They're my enemy and your... Like, I told you all this on text, but, like, there was... Especially the second episode. There are so many times when someone is on the verge of having to explain the entire Protestant Reformation to the Japanese. It's like, yeah.
And you were here
this
for
this is absolutely sick content. Oh, poor dumb what's-his-face, huh?
Buntaro?
No, not Buntaro. Omi? He's dumb. He's dumb in a different way. No, Torunaga's son.
Oh yes, let's talk about him.
Poor fate. Poor guy.
What fate does he?
What an end.
Yeah, he meets his maker by slipping on a rock after all the big talk and, you know, obvious foreshadowing of, I want to go to war.
Yeah,
going to war is better than pillowing a woman.
You just knew this poor hapless fool, feckless idiot, was going to have something happen to him. And so fitting that he just slips on the rock, right?
Kind of a relief if you are rooting for Torunaga that this liability didn't cause more damage than he already has on the way out.
That's a good point.
I have questions related to it, but just the moment itself, the sound design team deserves whatever... whatever award they can win for that, because that was the brother already injuring himself, slipping on the rock. You know, he's hobbled. And so you're kind of already thinking, like, if fate is setting things up, it is not executing very gloriously. You know, there's nothing, like, beautiful about... There's no battle to the death. They're, like, scrounging around in a decorative pond and breaking their ankle and then just splat. Man.
There's been some good, you know... This just made me. This is pure association, but there's been like some excellent sound work in this series. I'm thinking too, especially of the episode that ends with Ishido's men being blown apart by cannons.
Fantastic!
It feels like visceral. Mm-hmm. Like that was an excellent. That was an excellently created scene.
That and the earthquake as well.
The earthquake was great. Like the chaos at the tea house at the end of this episode, and yeah, like you could like the sound and the design kind of. Really shows that like nobody really knows what's going on. You know, they are just like flailing around.
Well,
a boy doing something silly and a man trying to escape.
And him wheezing and the blood slowly going into the, you know, on the Japanese garden.
Yeah,
with the blood slowly making its way through that water. Very very serene, the red dye going through the water. But the question I would have. Well, there's two questions related to the Willow world that I have. One is the woman who has featured fairly prominently, what's her name? I'm going to blank on it.
The one who owns it, Gin?
No, not the owner. She's part of my next question.
Kiku.
Yeah. Is she involved in this plot? Is this going to go poorly for her? Or did the son just kind of storm the castle and shove everybody out of the way?
I honestly at first was like, okay, Torunaga just done the favor for Gin, right? In his will. So, and then they cut to that. I'm like, okay, here it goes.
Right.
And it seems so, like, ham-handed. Like, there's no way, like, the way his son did it was so obviously sloppy and ham-handed.
I would have trusted the women
there's,
like, to
there's
do
no,
it.
There's no way.
Yeah. Why not put it in the hands of those ladies?
Yeah. But the second question, I just like them. I don't want anything bad to happen to them as a any sort of payback. The second question, when she does go to him and is asking him, can we have this district in Edo, right? To so that we don't have to grow old in this grotesque way. She completely comprehends the situation that he's put himself in and lays it all out. But that doesn't come up again in the episode.
Not really. Although it's like...
But he knows that she's right.
It's a reminder for us the whole rest of the episode that, yeah, like he's...
He may still be in control somehow.
Yeah, like either he's up to something or like he really... things really are. You know, like it's a real question.
She doesn't believe that things are as chaotic for him as he's portraying.
Yes.
Right.
And I'm fascinated. And I love the... And I know that's like a... The wise old prostitute kind of trope being used, but it's still fun.
I also, the whole time I've been watching it, like there are enough heads in baskets that I can just, all I can think of is that late season episode of Barry where Hank gets a bunch of heads and no ho Hank gets, it's like, oh, it's a head. Like, open them. Like you know it's a head. It's like, what did I expect? Another head.
Well, they even kind of did that this time. He was like, yeah.
I know.
Again.
Yeah, exactly. I wondered why he even bothered opening it.
It was great. That was good stuff.
All right. Well, more on Shogun as we get into the last three episodes. Yeah, we don't know. Some of this will unfold, obviously, next week. So we'll see it then. We'll take a break, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Sugar on the next. I really hate that the other two guys couldn't contribute to the talk about Sugar on Apple TV Plus. The visual language of this show just knocked me off my feet in the first 3 minutes. And to see Colin Farrell at his Ray Velcoro best here is the sugar and the icing on the cake, if you'll let me be really dumb with my language. The pitch had to have been obvious. Let's do a classic LA noir and set it in 2023 or 2024 or so. Oh, and Colin Farrell's the lead, and we'll have a twisty visual flair that'll help sell the world that it's set in. It's got quick cuts, varied angles, some use of black and white footage, all to say what? That I think it serves to keep you off kilter. When shows or movies do this, though, it does give me a sense that the director has an idea or knows exactly what he or she wants. I hope that's the case here. At the very least, it's visually entertaining. In the case of Sugar, it just adds to the pacing as well. It's digestible. I mean, even foregoing what's become customary cold opens for a show seems like either a callback of yesteryear or a move forward for television. The first episode blends these old shots from the 60s and 70s into the mix as if it's not sure of the time period that it's in. I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes a part of the narrative. A lot of information is given early in the first episode titled Olivia, in the way that Sugar handles things and reacts. Yet they also wisely dole out more things through his interactions, conversations, and his movements even, to keep you wondering. In the first 30 minutes from Japan to LA, from rescuing a kidnapped kid to attempting to help a homeless man and his dog, just paints this utterly fascinating character that you ride around with no matter how long it takes him to find Jonathan Siegel's granddaughter, which is the basis of the first episode. Jonathan Siegel, famous producer and director, getting old in his years. His granddaughter hasn't been around for 2 weeks. Now, she's a known addict, and that's what Sugar does. He finds people. Now, what we know about Sugar after episode one are these things. He's multilingual. He's gentlemanly. He's caring. He's intelligent. He can't get drunk, I don't think. That seemed to be true. He loves movies, he hates guns, he isn't married, he mentions someone named Jen, he has a handler named Ruby. Oh, and he could be hallucinating and taking some medication straight into his neck with a syringe. There are also one or two signs he may not be a reliable narrator, even though he's doing the voiceover for the show. Worth noting that the invitation he gets is to, quote, a society of polyglots, which are people who are capable of speaking a lot of languages. Now, what we know about the case, the granddaughter Olivia has been missing for 2 weeks. She's been in and out of recovery for, it seems like, heroin. Her grandfather misses her. He's a rich producer and director. We don't really know much about her father. Her half-brother, he's quick to point out he's the half-brother, does not seem like a sensitive type. He's also the type to trapeze around with a bodyguard of his own, whom he uses to follow Sugar. Olivia's former stepmom's a former rock and roller who hangs out most days at a bar. Olivia's actual mom was an actress who had died in a wreck in 1998. Oh, and there's a body of a dead man in Olivia's trunk. Now, what to make of all that? If nothing else, just know that Colin Farrell's perfectly cast here. Now, in the second episode, it's more of the same, and that's not a pejorative. John Sugar talks to Bernie, that's Olivia's dad, we finally meet him, and this guy has no concern for her, yet later on, a surprising amount of concern for Davey, the son, the half-brother. Thanks to GPS, John Sugar's also determined that the dead male in the trunk is a man named Clifford, who has raped and killed a young lady named Rachel Vasquez. And Olivia's car seems to have been there the night that Vasquez was killed, or at least in that time around there. John Sugar reveals in his noir voiceover that Jen was his sister. We get that bit of information. It's of note that the subtitle spells Jen with a D, D-J-E-N. And by the end of episode two, we know that the body in the trunk was Clifford, that probable killer and rapist. But he was involved with Carmen Vasquez. I think I called her Rachel earlier, sorry. He was involved with Carmen Vasquez somehow, whom he probably raped and killed. Now, Clifford's also one of some thugs, the head thug being played by the excellent Eric Lang. He is fantastic character actor, can do it all. The guy has range. Watch him in Escape from Dannemora from Showtime. Such a good show. It's directed by Ben Stiller. Really good series. Eric Lang also in Perry Mason. Unbelievable on Netflix. He's done it all, and he's really, really good. I'm excited to see what he does here. And he's not too nice of a guy because he's threatening Carmen Vasquez's sister. These Vasquez sisters know Melanie, who's the rock and roll stepmom, Olivia's stepmom, and Bernie's ex-wife. Bernie is hiding quite a bit and also trying to track down John Sugar and see what he's up to. But, you know, Olivia's stepmom, Melanie's hiding something. John Sugar has figured that out. Plus, Colin Farrell's John Sugar can sleep sitting straight up. That's what we know by the end of episode two. This show is supposedly has a twist coming. Thanks, Alan Sepinwall, for telling us that. Don't know why you'd want to mention that. What's the point? But I'm still all in on this one. It's wonderful. The visual flair of the show is so fascinating and fun. You just don't see a character with as much heart as John Sugar as the protagonist these days. That could go sideways. I don't know how reliable he is, but I am in on this one. The first two episodes had me. And yeah, I would watch. If you made it this far, you probably have watched it. That's going to be it for this week. Follow the podcast in your app. If you like YouTube, subscribe to the Alabama Takes YouTube channel there. And all the podcasts and things will be there for you to view. As well as Taking It Down on Video. Taking It Down on Video airs every Wednesday evening around 5:30 or 6. Check out the new and improved site, thealabamatake.com, if you haven't already. And we will see you later.